When your parents name you Happy Doll, you only have one choice in life. Get sucked into a seedy underbelly of crime. Which makes Jason Woodbury wonder,
Why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can riff from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, and joining me this week is Jason Woodbury, an editor and contributor at beloved music website Aquarium Drunkard and host of the Transmissions podcast, not to mention the creative director of Hello Merch, a combination record label apparel brand that also helps independent bands do their own printing and merch sales. Jason, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us about A Man Named Doll and why we need more Jonathan Ames adaptations.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And I've raved pretty considerably about these books to anybody who will listen. I really enjoyed this first Happy Doll book and then the sequel that came out a few years later.
Well, I was so happy you pitched this because I've been a fan of Jonathan Ames since the beginning. I got my start writing for New York Press, the New York City All Weekly that was the big competitor of the Village Voice, and he was a writer there. And so I never met him, but we were published in the same issues sometimes, and I felt a kinship there. And then he's gone on to write a bunch of books, create Bored to Death, and yet the last thing of his I read was You Were Never Here, and I somehow didn't find out these even came out.
Yeah. I don't feel like I did either. And I'm a pretty big fan as well. I'm a fan of Jonathan Ames's writing in general. He didn't do a lot of necessarily music writing, but he did write some really cool pieces for Spin. I remember his Marilyn Manson feature, although I'm not a fan of Marilyn Manson. I remember that feature making a big impression on me. And I'm a big fan of his essay collections. I really like The Double Life is Twice as Nice. And I enjoyed You Were Never Really Here a lot. That's such an incredible book. And I thought when it came out, novella, it's a very short, slim collection. And I remember thinking, Ames is really good at writing violent sequences. He's extremely adept at creating this kind of violence in a narrative that I think doesn't undersell the brutality of it. Like it always feels like it hurts. And I remember thinking that as much as I love Bored to Death, and I was like, wow, but this is just a really interesting place for him to go with that book. I feel like the Happy Doll books really do marry the sweetness and charm and joie de vivre of like the Bored to Death universe with that stark, pulpy, direct violence of You Were Never Really Here. So I found these books just to be the perfect middle zone between those two.
It's funny, I had exactly the same thought in my notes. It's two very tough tones to juggle.
Yeah, for sure. When these books, when they get violent, oftentimes it seemingly comes out of nowhere and the tone shifts so quickly on a dime. And I think that that speaks to the sort of the way that when something catastrophic happens, it does feel like it's coming from, completely out of view. And it just all of a sudden it's upon you. I feel like that's what happens so often with this character, Happy Doll. But yeah, I absolutely love these books. And it's impossible not to think of adaptations when reading them, because they just feel like ripe for a sort of neo-noir type vibe. And I could visualize almost everything that was happening.
Well, this owes so much. He's clearly doing a homage to a lot of LA noir, which there's a long tradition of from, Chinatown, the Elliot Gould Long Goodbye to the Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
And this is almost like a slightly more gruesome Big Lebowski, because this guy is just kind of a affable stoner who's also ex-military and an ex-cop. Like, he's an interesting character because you buy all of this about him, that he can play the heavy, but he's mostly just a goofball who loves his dog too much.
Yeah, and I mean, the dog element is also very important to me. I love George the dog, and I love the way he writes about the dog and writes about Happy's relationship with the dog is really one of the most delightful parts of these books.
Yeah, it's almost like George has kind of become like the surrogate spouse for Happy, and Jonathan Ames knows that, but Happy does not.
Yeah, he makes a few jokes about that, about like the perversity of their relationship, which I found so amusing. But yeah, Happy is absolutely, he's a strange character because he's ex-Navy, he's an ex-cop, and he has a very defined sense of morality and righteousness. and a willingness to try to help. But he also is a bumbling stoner and, you know, throws himself into situations but can't quite manage them. You know, at least that's the way it often seems to go for him. But something that I really like, and, you know, I figure it probably doesn't make much sense for us to spoil the books too much or like get completely into the weeds with the plot, but there's something that I really appreciate in the second book, The Wheel of Dahl, which I hope that if they were going to make movies of this, they would just make multiples. But the second book, there's a scene in it where he's talking about his place in Los Angeles and he has planted trees for some people who died in the first book. And so there's a sense of like, he's got this like Buddhist sensibility of sort of like the weight of what has happened and paying homage to these lives taken, even if maybe he felt that he had to take said lives. But I found that to be a really cool wrinkle.
It's a really great insight into the character, but it also, you know, so many series of detective books, it's like a sort of an old TV show where they hit the reset button every week.
Yeah.
And the previous cases don't necessarily weigh on the person.
Yeah.
And so it's great to have that connection that he's still thinking about the people in book one and book two.
Yeah, not to mention that similar to folks who have seen the Lynn Ramsey, Joaquin Phoenix adaptation of You Were Never Really There, you'll get a sense that in a similar way with these books, with the Happy Dahl books, Jonathan really puts this character through the ringer. He gets, you know, really screwed up. He gets beat up and he carries those marks of violence forward in the narrative. You know, like you said, they don't go away magically. It's not like the end of the sitcom where everything resets and it's back.
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of carries through. But yeah, you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned The Long Goodbye, the Elliot Gould, the Altman adaptation. That's one of my all-time favorite movies. It's one of those movies that I can watch anytime.
Yeah, yeah.
Similarly, The Big Lebowski. I like to tell people that I have a more complex favorite Coen Brothers movie. You know, I like to be able to say, you know, A Serious Man might be their best movie. And I believe that. But from a pure...
But which one are you watching on a Sunday afternoon? Come on.
I'm watching Big Lebowski. I mean, Big Lebowski is what I'm going to put on to watch a movie and enjoy it. I don't get sick of that movie, you know? And I think that Long Goodbye and Big Lebowski both, you know, there's this sort of micro genre within the neo-noir thing that is really interesting. And it's a term that the writer James Salas, who wrote Drive, the book that the Ryan Gosling film was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's got this term that I really, really like called sunshine noir. And I feel like, you know, Long Goodbye, Big Lebowski, they fit into that category. You could say that Drive does too. Nicholas Winding Refn, say his name. I like that movie. I haven't revisited it in a long time. I remember feeling like it was stylized in a way that put me at a remove from those noir connotations. So much. I mean, they're there kind of, but it's such a hype pop kind of glossy neon thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It ends up feeling different. The novel itself, Drive, and the other books that James Salas has written in that series, first off, they're set in Arizona, which I really like, at being somebody from Arizona. But two, they feel like they have that sunshine noir quality. And I feel like A Man Named Dahl also has that. And I would imagine a film adaptation maintaining sort of that sunshiny quality, which isn't to say that it's like so much noir is LA, you know, already. But I think that there's a weird kind of like, maybe it's the stoner element that brings a little bit of lightness to the proceedings in a way that not everything is. But yeah, I found myself thinking a lot about that term and about films that would maybe fall into that category as I was considering what a movie adaptation of this might look like.
Yeah, yeah. One that just came to me when, as you were talking, one of my favorites with sunshine noirs is Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
because sure. It's almost all during the daytime and that desert sun is just oppressive. And yeah. It uses that kind of in the opposite way that like traditional noir uses the dark, but it's part of the atmosphere. And, you know, the sun sort of takes its toll on everybody the same way. Like there's a lot of things that are just blinding and you feel the heat of the desert and it's like the brightness kind of traps you as much as the darkness can. You were talking about like Nicholas Winding Refn, you know, being very stylized. One thing I was thinking about reading this book with an eye towards how we make it into a movie is you don't want to stylize it at all, I think. I think that takes a lot of directors off the table because as much as there is a little bit of playfulness in Happy being a big stoner and, you know, having this love affair with his dog and all this stuff, there are some light elements. But yeah, he really, really gets hurt. And
and hurts others.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the people he's up against are not colorful, you know, Coen Brothers type criminals for the most part. Like, these are, you know, serious people who want to do people harm. And so I think you need to set this in a very realistic, and also this is a guy who's made a shambles of his life.
Yeah.
And is still trying to do the right thing and help people when he can. And so you need to show that shambles, and you need to, it needs to be like very down to earth, and you can still have the lightness of tone here and there. It doesn't have to be quite as like gritty as You Were Never Here.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I thought a lot about that. And I thought that it makes the, what ends up happening in the book makes for a more complicated adaptation than, I mean, as I was thinking of potential directors, I also, yeah, I found myself taking a lot of people off the table as I thought it through, because one, there's an element of like stoner comedy. Two, there's the noir LA private detective Philip Marlowe element. And then three, it almost shifts into horror, you know.
Novel. Yeah, the third act is when he finds out what the...
Right, that ends up shifting the tone from these other two tones that are already a little bit disparate into this third tone, which is also, you need a very fleet-footed director to take this on, you know. And I thought it made me think about other kind of like, you know, Inherent Vice comes to mind for me too, in the sort of Sunshine noir vibe.
Oh yeah, yeah.
With the stoner detective. So I thought a lot about that. I thought about, it's not the exact same thing, but I was a big fan of the show Lodge 49 on AMC. I think that that is sort of like mystic surfer sunshine noir sort of thing. And so there's some touches of that in this for me. And then I also thought a lot about the film Under the Silver Lake, which was a divisive one. I loved it. I think that's a really good movie. And in a weird way, it has a little bit of that tonal juxtaposition. I don't think that director makes perfect sense for this, but I nonetheless thought about it and thought about the way they were able to juggle these different aesthetic zones with that movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to do because so many directors have like a mode they operate in. And even just for an audience, if the tone swings too wildly, you know, you kind of lose everybody.
Yeah, which I think makes all of this like a little, it's a tall ask to adapt this one in a way that works. Because at least for me, as a reader, I'm not the world's fastest reader. I'm certainly not the world's slowest reader. But when it comes to these books, you can tell that Ames was very specifically writing this page turnery kind of thing. You know, the sentences are short. The structure is easy to understand. The momentum is forward. It's spelled out in a way that not at all clumsy or rushed or anything like that, but there's just a propulsive quality to the pages and the sentences and the use of language. And I found myself thinking, like, how long is this movie? Maybe this is a kind of short movie in the way that they're kind of short books. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Well, one thing that we often end up asking on this show is like movie or streaming series.
Yeah.
And if he had written more than two, like, I think we did, if we just force him to write eight more books, then we've got to. But in fact, I could almost see this as a series set up like Sherlock was, where a season was just three long episodes and you have kind of three short movies.
Yeah, that would probably work. And I mean, I have to imagine, I hope that there are a lot more books in this. You know, Bored to Death was a show that I love. I mean, I really enjoyed that show. And I revisited
it. Same here.
Fairly recently, and I found that it really holds up, and it's very funny. And the character of George in Bored to Death, I've found myself wondering if the dog is named in an homage to George. I'm not sure. But, you know, he had another show after Bored to Death 2, Blunt Talk.
Oh, yeah, with Patrick Stewart.
I don't think I ended up watching all that much of that one. I did watch a few episodes.
I don't think too many people did. I think that's why I came and went.
I do remember sort of enjoying what I saw. And as a massive, you know, Star Trek fan, which I am, which doesn't help much for this conversation, but nonetheless, Patrick Stewart was pretty good in Blunt Talk in the episodes I watched. I enjoyed watching him in a comedic role, but Brent Spiner, Data from Next Generation, was also really good in it. So,
oh, I didn't even realize he was also in it.
Yeah, he's in it as well. And that's about all I remember about Blunt Talk. But I think Bored to Death worked really well as a series because the private detective setup allowed for those episodes to feel very natural and for continued action to make sense, you know?
So yeah, yeah, yeah.
I could see this working in the same way. But I will say that of the two Happy Doll books so far, both cases end up feeling like they would need, yeah, maybe something like a limited series format, you know, three episodes or something like that to really tease it out, you know, longer episodes, but fewer of them. So often with streaming series and stuff, there ends up being the filler and the sort of like stretching of the narrative in order to make it work more in that serialized format. So I don't know. I think I would see these as movies before seeing them as TV. Maybe not.
And also for this kind of thing where our hero gets put through the ringer, you can only do that so many times before it becomes a Lars von Trier movie. Like, I'm a big fan of Ken Bruin's Irish crime novels. He's a fantastic writer. He has such a facility with language. Mm-hmm. And he comes up with good storylines. But, you know, the tone's a little more serious than this. But his protagonist, like, he's an addict and a drunk, and that keeps coming back, and he falls on and off the wagon at different times. But then all these sort of tragedies either befall him or are carried out by him. And so the first couple of books are fantastic. And after a certain point, it's like, how much misery can you pile onto this guy?
Sure.
And it gets to be too much. And so, yeah, I think you do have to keep that kind of thing in small doses. And maybe, yeah, you know, maybe not every book is quite as severe as the first one in terms of like what happens to this guy.
It would be hard for every book to be as severe as what happens in this one.
Well, there wouldn't be much of him left.
There wouldn't be much of him left. But yeah, the second book, The Wheel of Dahl, I really enjoyed that one too. And, you know, that's a whole other bag of worms is what I was about to say. That doesn't really make that much sense, but that's a whole other case. And it's really good too. It's a little bit, takes the character to some new places and puts some different tones in the mix, but maintains a similar thing. But what I will say, one cool thing about it is that you do get a sense of this character as a real person and that he seems to be sort of growing and evolving as a person, which is nice to see while still being like a pretty unrepentant stoner. And in fact, the drugs get amplified big time in the second book. So you need a director who's also capable of capturing the sort of manic states of either ecstatic, you know, clarity or completely puzzled, you know, lost.
And yeah, historically portraying drug use, you know, realistically on screen is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think, you know, so Happy's main thing is he's into weed. And so I guess,
well,
you know,
I think it's not spoiling too much to say like in the first book, he gets hurt badly in the beginning.
Yeah.
And so then he's on like some pretty powerful painkillers.
Yeah.
And then you kind of get a lot of him like self-medicating and trying to not go too far, but also having to like keep himself together to get through this mystery. And he ends up mixing drugs and all this stuff. I'll also say, I read the first book for this and I ran out of time to read the second one. But, you know, we keep talking without trying to spoil too much about what sort of things happens to him. He does get hurt badly, gets put through the ringer and all this, but there's also an optimism to him. He is always thinking about how like he's going to turn things around. There's a woman we haven't mentioned who, like his bartender, who they like slept together once and there's still a lot of affection there in both directions. And he's not quite sure how to approach, like he still very clearly has deep feelings for this woman. He isn't quite sure how to approach trying to rekindle things. And she's kind of a recurring figure. And he is very motivated to like get himself together and get himself into a place where he can be with this woman. And so even as like, he's kind of spiraling downward and upward at the same time. And I think that's what makes it work. It's not complete misery. It is, you can also see ahead to him, like maybe getting his shit together. Like it could go both ways for him.
Yeah.
And that's a better tone. That's an easier tone to sustain, I think, in terms of like relating to the character and wanting to watch more than like, oh, and another horrible thing happened to him. And he's even worse. And he's, you know, his drug use is even worse. It's like,
yeah,
he kind of like simultaneously gets better and worse. And so there's a hopefulness to that.
Yeah. When I was like looking through reviews of the books, you know, which I don't do all the time, looking through like Goodreads reviews, you know, trying to see what, like, not so much critics and stuff, but just sort of what normal readers thought of these. There were notes about how it felt monotonous, you know, that the character kind of always self-medicating again, always, you know, talking about how the alcohol plays with the cannabis, with the painkillers, and he's like doing a, and some people, I guess I can see that being like, you know, whatever, not somebody's bag or not what somebody wants to read about. But I don't know. I think it's probably Jonathan Ames is a pretty realistic person, and he's a pretty honest person about stuff that people aren't always so honest about, you know, about their foibles, about their weaknesses, about their sort of shame-based feelings. And I feel like all that surfaces in Happy, but also, like you said, there's this sense of also like self-compassion and self-recognition that you get. I don't know, Happy doesn't hate himself so much.
It's more that he's aware of all of his flaws. And
yeah,
and that makes a lot of sense for Jonathan Ames, because his early stuff, like his early essays, his writing for New York Press, was very much like shame-based personal essay, where he was very, very forthright and honest about like his sexual urges, his relationships gone bad, his drinking, his, it was really like, I'm a mess and I'm going to pour this out on you, you know, for the entertainment of you, the reader.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things I loved about New York Press back then.
Sure.
Because it was very much, it wasn't a newspaper. Because even the Village Voice was first and foremost like cultural coverage, some local news. This did some of that, but it was mostly, this newspaper was really like, this is what it is like for these interesting characters to live in New York.
Yeah.
You know, like Jim Knipfel was one of their like long running writers who was going blind, and very, very funny, very sardonic writer who would just write about the challenges of being like a cranky, stubborn guy who does not want to cope with going blind. And it was a fascinating life that you don't necessarily often get exposed to. And then he was also just a really entertaining writer that like, he wrote like a 1200 word column about his hat falling off. That was the funniest thing he'd ever read.
Yeah.
It like blows under a car, and then he's completely at a loss, and he doesn't want to ask anybody for help because he's like in denial about being, you know, blind and needing help.
Sure.
And so Jonathan Ames' stuff was all that kind of stuff. It was very personal and very self-effacing, very, not even warts and all, is just like he wanted to focus in on the warts.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, just ready to just tear himself open and examine kind of the worst, most embarrassing parts of himself. And that honesty, like, that's not the point of this book or any of his other books, but that very painful self-awareness, I think, cuts through like everything that he writes.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that in some ways, I mean, I've read some interviews with him where people have asked him about some of that earlier writing and, you know, hey, do you think that would fly now? And he's like, no, not the same way. And I wouldn't write it the same way now. But that thing you're saying about how he's focusing in on the unsavory parts of himself and he's exposing them, I think he's just wired honestly in a certain way, right? It's sort of like, I can't lie because I don't have the faculty to lie. You know what I mean? Even when Happy Doll does obscure the truth, it's usually just sort of by omission. You know what I mean? He's not like going out of his way to come up with crazy stories. He has to sort of like hold some information back from the cops, but you almost get this sense that he's like, he's not lying so much. He's just leaving certain things out, you know?
And even then he kind of feels bad about it.
And he feels bad about it. That's one of the things that makes me love this character so much. As somebody who does struggle probably with that inner voice that's telling me that I'm doing something wrong, you know, often to way past the point of it being a useful voice or anything like that, as so often is the case. But, you know, I kind of like that. And I kind of like that he's honest and that he's got this, that he wears it all, you know, kind of on his sleeve or whatever.
Well, he's very human. Like, he also kills someone in self-defense at one point in the book, and then he's haunted by that.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that, because how many books does your hero off some dude and then that's it. He's moving on. Like, you would be screwed up. You would be scarred. It would weigh on you.
It would be
impossible for it not to, you know?
And especially in this, you know, sort of superhero movie era, or even non-superhero movies, like The Fast and the Furious is a superhero movie. And like a lot of action movies are just about these like unstoppable, tough dudes. But the really compelling, you know, the thing that is great about like Indiana Jones or Jackie Chan is that, you know they're the hero, you know they're going to come out on top, but they're in over their head for like the entire movie. James Bond, even a lot of the best Bonds, he's fighting a big, 250-pound Swedish dude who, can break a boards in half with his bare hands. And you're like, oh, how is he gonna? He's overmatched. How is he gonna get out of this one? And there's that sort of physically and emotionally with Happy Doll, that
Big time.
he loses a lot of fights. He's outmatched. He's in over his head. But also just he's really this is a guy who's been in the military, has been a cop, and he's still like traumatized by having to kill somebody in self-defense, and feels really bad about it. Like he's this very human, relatable character.
All that stuff really makes it that much more compelling to me, and I feel like sets him apart from so many. I love the Fast and the Furious movies, by the way. I just want to make that
Oh,
clear. I am a,
they're great, but you kind of
but
you need
at
a
least the good ones. There are the last one really, I couldn't make it all the way through it, to be honest. But I like a lot of them, so I
No,
know
but the
what you
good
mean.
ones, they're also like I wrote for the AV Club, and we always got shit in the comments about like how could you give Crank with Jason Statham an A and then this art house movie like a B minus? But the rubric we used was how well does it succeed at what it is trying to do? It's not how does this compare to Citizen Kane. It is how well does this do the thing that it's trying to do? And Crank does the thing that it's trying to do really, really well. The good Fasts and Furiouses do the thing they're trying to do very, very well.
Crank is so good. And maybe you'll remember, please help me, but did the Crank team also do Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance? Am I making that up?
Oh,
Or
I don't know, but that makes a lot of sense.
I think that that might be the case. I think that's a underrated Gonzo movie in the Crank, in
Yeah,
the
in that
vein of
vein.
a
Yeah,
Crank, of the Crank
yeah.
vein.
Yeah, do you want to get into like cast and director? I guess there's not a ton to talk about because it's not that big a cast.
Specifically, we could maybe let's start with director. Did you think of anybody who you'd want to see direct it?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about how it's very tricky because there's a lot of tones to juggle, and I feel like the conversation has to start with Lynn Ramsey, who directed You Were Never Really Here, which was another Jonathan Ayme detective story, another adaptation. But we talked about this. That was a much darker book. It was a lot more serious. And she did. We need to talk about Kevin. Like her movies are really like serious as cancer, and she does that extremely well. And she's a phenomenal director. But I don't think maybe she has it in her to do the sort of lightness of tone that's also here. But I've never seen it. And so this might be two on the nose. Maybe the Safdie brothers who did Uncut Gems.
Well, that's really funny because, spoiler, I put Benny Safdie as Happy Doll, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I've been really taken by The Curse, the show that he's doing with Nathan Fielder, and find him a very compelling actor. I think he's too good looking for Happy Doll, but I also think that you're probably going to always end up with a too good-looking actor of the current slate of people. I thought he would relish, though, getting to have the makeup put on and have him get, more and more whooped as it goes
Oh,
on. You know what I mean?
yeah. Let's come back around to director because one of the problems with casting this is what you really want is the kind of busted looking, sort of older character actors we had loads of in the 70s and very few of today.
Oh,
Because even
yeah.
our old actors, like Harrison Ford is 80, he looks like $1 million. And like one of the people you need to cast is the story, the first book, the story opens with Happy's old friend Lou Shelton. He was his mentor as a cop. He's like an old liver spotted, kind of broken down guy who's a chain smoker. He's on his last legs. He needs a kidney. He comes to Happy asking if he'll donate a kidney to him so he can live a couple more years because otherwise he's going to be dead in 6 months. So this is just like a decrepit old man. And there just aren't decrepit old man actors anymore. Like, who do you get?
I don't
And
know.
Happy also is like, it's a very narrow tightrope to walk because he's an ex-military guy, he's an ex-cop, he has to be a little bit of a bruiser. But he's also completely gone to seed because he kind of knows his like best days are behind him as a detective. Like he was thriving and now he's not. And then he's somebody who can be tough, but he's also like he's a big stoner. He's kind of a big softy who loves his dog. And he's very often a coward. You can't just put like Jason Statham in this. Like it has to be somebody who can play all those things. Like I think Benny Safdie is a good choice for that reason. Cause I struggled with this one more than I usually do on this show.
I'm glad to hear that because I struggled a lot.
Yeah, this was a tough one. Like I thought, like maybe Ben Affleck, because we've kind of seen him gone to seed, and maybe he's also somebody who could maybe direct and star on this. But I don't know. Despite that, he's done like a couple of Kevin Smith movies, a couple of comedies. Like I don't know if he quite has that lighter side of the character because he's a little Happy's a little bit of a likable goofball.
Yeah.
To a degree that I don't necessarily see from 2023 Ben Affleck. And then too far in the other direction, I thought maybe Jake Johnson, if he's ready for like a more serious turn, but I don't really see the tough guy side of him.
Once he undergoes the MCU transformation and he gets like an 18 pack and
that's true.
Ripped, you know, and
he's only doing superhero voice work. So
yeah, he is great though. He's somebody who I certainly could see in this character.
But then if he goes to the MCU transformation, they make him more handsome and he needs to be less handsome for this.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. I think he could kind of work, right? Like if he bulked up maybe just a tiny bit, you know, I don't get the sense that Happy is like a real yoked guy. He's not like he's not buff per se, but he's in the position that he has to be able to handle himself, you know?
Yeah, so, I feel like he's more like wiry and tight. He's like a guy who can take a punch, not a guy who's like bulked up.
Yeah, that's great. He'd make a good, that's a good one. I like that a lot.
Well, I wasn't sure whether he could do the tough guy side of it quite well enough. And I landed on Peter Sarsgaard, who he can play a tough guy, but he can also be goofy and likable. And is like a capital A actor, which on one hand, this is like, a detective story doesn't necessarily call for Olivier, but at the same time, it is a really tricky character. And I feel like you need somebody on that level maybe to do this. But that being said, I actually kind of think Benny Safdie is the best choice I've heard.
I dig that. Yeah. You know who else I thought about, but kind of talked my, it was similar in the Harrison Ford vein. I really like Chris Pine in pretty much everything I've seen him in. He's so good looking. He's so charming.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I kind of imagined him, maybe his hair's grown out a little bit. Maybe the outfits are a little less, perfectly tailored. I don't know.
But yeah, I
thought of him.
Well, I feel like you could dirty him up a little bit and he would go for that.
Yeah, I think he'd dig it. I think he'd dig it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, yeah, I think Chris Pine, I also like him in a ton of things he's been in. And I think he could get the tone really well. But yeah, he's so handsome. And that's not what I want is like over the summer, I was in a big like New York in the 70s kick. And I rewatched The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. And one of my favorite things about it is Walter Matthau, is the subway employee who has to solve this like subway hijacking. And the most dashing, handsome movie star in the thing is Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
Like, it's just every single character, all the way up to the mayor, is just some like schlubby guy who just wants to get through his workday.
Yeah.
And it's great because of that. It's like, it feels like real 70s New York because it's just these like broken down old like mugs with their, cup of coffee, smoking a cigarette, thinking like, ah, crap, I got to get through this.
I love that too. I kind of recently rewatched Friends of Eddie Coyle and found myself thinking similarly, like, these are just all normal looking dudes, I already mentioned that The Long Goodbye is a huge movie for me and one of my favorites. I feel like Elliot Gould kind of is somewhere in the middle of what we're talking about. There's a quality about him that is sort of the everyman-ish thing. But then when you really look at him, you're like, no, he's super good looking. He's like a total hunk, right? But like, Philip Marlowe in the Altman Long Goodbye doesn't scan as like the hunkiest dude to me, So somehow it works. It's like you said, that scruffing up a little bit would be required of probably anybody we get to do the Happy Doll role.
Yeah. And it is a good trick because like George Clooney could never, ever do that.
No.
He can't turn off that charm or that good. And actually one of the most, this doesn't really have anything to do with the movie we're talking about, but one of the most striking performances I've seen in the last couple months is the current season of Fargo, where John Hamm is the villain. And one of the many things John Hamm does really well is he's super charming and compelling, even when his character is kind of a dick, because that was Don Draper. That like really on paper, he's a terrible person. He just plays the heel the whole way. And you're right there with him because he's just so handsome and charming.
Yeah.
And he kind of starts as like the Minnesota version of that. And then he just gets worse and worse until all the charm is just drained from his face.
Yeah.
And you almost look at him and you're like, why would anybody like this guy or find him attractive. And it's John Hamm. Like,
yeah, that's a feat.
You almost need to find somebody who can, I guess not in terms of like being drained of all sympathy, but like, maybe since we only have these like good looking buff Hollywood actors, you need somebody who can like act their way to looking like a busted old wreck.
Yeah. And I feel like Benny Safdie could do it. You know, I think he has like the right, I mean, like watching The Curse, I don't know if I believe the story that Benny Safdie told fairly recently about John Medeski, the composer, asking him, you know, well into working on the first episode, who's this guy you got to play Dougie? Because he's like so cringe, you know, this guy. And he's like, that's me. You know, that sounds a little too perfect, you know?
Yeah,
that sounds
yeah,
a little
yeah, yeah.
too well put together as a story for it to be totally true. But I will say that, like, he doesn't scan as the guy you saw in Oppenheimer, you know? He doesn't scan as the guy you saw in Good Time, you know? It's like he does have that kind of classic ability to sink into the character in a way that is maybe would be helpful for this. And I definitely think the Safdie brothers, they're so good at the tension and the constant anxiety that could definitely work for this movie. I thought about them for sure as directors.
Well, that tension is exactly what makes this kind of movie run.
Yeah.
And so you have to be able to do that. So yeah, I think I'm sold on them to direct and star.
Who I came up with for director is somebody who I think has only done one other film. I was thinking about, as I mentioned, you know, the Sunshine Noir thing, I was kind of going down the rabbit hole with stuff like Under the Silver Lake and Inherent Vice, as I mentioned. But a few years back, there was a Netflix film called I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Did you ever get a chance to see that?
No, I don't know that one.
So it's Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood and Jane Levy, Devon Gray, and then David Yao is in it, who's also in Under the Silver, like the singer of the Jesus Lizard. The director who did that is named Macon Blair. And I really loved that movie. It was a comedy that veered into violence, or maybe it was a crime movie that veered into comedy. There was something about the way that worked. Now, look, I actually don't have my sister-in-law's Netflix password quit working for me, so I haven't had Netflix in a minute. But what I will say is, who knows if it's even still on Netflix or if there's any other way to watch it, knowing the way that stuff goes, right?
Where I mean, from one week to the next, like, I mean, it'll in the week it takes me to edit and post this episode, Netflix could have taken off a third of their stuff. Like, who knows?
Sure, but if you can somehow track down I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, Macon Blair, I think I really liked that movie, and I really liked the delicate line between brutality and comedy and moments that are very endearing. Elijah Wood's very good in it. Yeah, I just think it's like you said, that it has to be somebody whose tone, I don't know if Jordan Peele makes sense, but Jordan Peele's an example of somebody who can walk tones and can shift into a new territory as the film seems to demand it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah, so yeah.
It's just got to be somebody like that. It's got to be somebody who's... I'm a huge... Probably my favorite artist is David Lynch. I am such a huge David Lynch fan. I don't think David Lynch would make sense for this movie whatsoever, but he's nonetheless an example of somebody who very funny things happen next to very romantic things, and then very romantic things happen right next to some cosmic horror that is beyond imagining, you know?
Yeah.
So I think about that. I thought a little bit about like Rick Alverson as well. Did you ever see, I just blanked. Is it the Tim Heidecker movie? Was it called Entertainment? Anyway,
oh, I don't know.
You should cut this part out. I don't know where I'm going with this. But when I interviewed Tim Heidecker once for Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions, we talked about how his songs, you know, people are like, well, are they funny songs? And he's like, no, they're not funny. Not funny the way my comedy's funny. Maybe they're funny sometimes, but it's not the same thing. And I remember kind of talking with him about how sometimes it makes people very uncomfortable when things don't, they don't play out exactly as you expect them. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah. Or they don't fall into like a neat bucket.
When they don't fall into a neat bucket, you know, that can throw people. For me, that's when it becomes like really good. You know,
oh,
that's
yeah.
Usually that's what life is, right? I mean,
and also
funny jokes at funerals.
Well, sometimes humor works better when it's not, there's no expectation to be funny. Like The Sopranos is one of the funniest shows on TV.
Oh.
Because it didn't need to be funny. There was no pressure to have jokes the way there would be for a sitcom or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was going to say there was one other element that I wanted to talk about because it'd be impossible for me not to, which is I found myself thinking an awful lot about what the soundtrack would be like, what the musical character of the film would be, because that's so important to me. And I think also very important to noir, you know, is the sort of soundtrack EQs. And there was a guy who worked on Bored to Death, did some music for Bored to Death, named Pat Irwin. And he's in a band called Suss, S-U-S-S. And they're an ambient country combo. And so he's really good at these dark, brooding, atmospherics, sort of sound that you could say is descended from like the Brian Eno, Roger Eno, Daniel Lanois, Apollo.
Yeah.
Soundtracks. They kind of are in that zone. So I think you could pair that, those sort of more atmospheric things, with jazzier stuff, you know, to sort of help give some shape to those shifting tones, right?
Oh, yeah, because also, like, you know, jazz is very noir. The Daniel Lanois sound, I think, is very L.A.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And there's so many cool jazz, modern jazz people who are pulling from all sorts of different styles and still scan as jazz, you know, Jeff Parker or, I don't know, Angel Bat Dawid or Tom Skinner, all these different people associated with like the International Anthem label or something like that. Or you could get Mark Ribot, the sort of like cool guitar, Rain Dogs, noir.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff would be great. You pair that with this more atmospheric stuff, and I think then maybe you've got a little bit of a skeleton key for how you can segue in and out of those things. You know what I mean? At least that's the way I hear it.
I think Ribot would be great because like so much of his stuff is just a little off kilter or off key or like,
oh yeah,
you know, he has this kind of junkyard. Like he's done a lot of stuff with Tom Waits, but he was part of the like, you know, like the downtown New York kind of artsy scene in the 90s. And like, and yet he's a New York guy who I feel like could sound very LA. Like,
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think he'd be great. I'll also add that like, we rarely talk about soundtrack on this show and it's my favorite thing when we do.
I'm glad. I mean, I knew that, like, you know, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to be able to bring to this, but I was like, but I could probably bring that side of it.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I think that, you know, I could really hear that. I like Bored to Death had that sort of strutty, jazzy thing, you know, and I always liked that. It helped to give it that lighthearted feel. But having that and then being able to pair it with like darker, spookier sounds, I think could be a really effective thing.
And it is, like you said, it is a good way to like fine tune the tone.
Yeah. Yeah.
For, you know, for the listener.
Yeah, I think so. I think these would make so much sense as movies, but they would be a little, maybe they'd be a little tricky. As long as they cast the right Chihuahua Terrier to play George, then I think the movie would be successful.
Well, George is the linchpin of the whole thing.
George is the linchpin of the whole thing. And one thing happens in the first book that caused me to gasp, like actually gasp.
Yeah.
And so we can't say that much more there, but I do think that as a dog person, Jonathan Ames is able to use the character of George is actually sort of the linchpin of the whole thing. He is like, I think that Happy maybe views George as like a I don't know, some sort of a little holy being that he's attempting to like, you know, become as good as. And I think that there's some sweetness to that, you know? And so,
well, I think it's the thing that keeps him like grounded and kind of, you know, if he's a guy who lives alone,
yeah,
and, you know, smokes too much weed and drinks too much and has screwed up his relationships and his career and all this stuff, then he's a very like pitiable figure. But because he dotes on this little dog,
yeah,
you know, like he has an emotional life.
Yeah.
You know, because of this, it's the thing that separates him from being like the hard-bitten, down on his luck detective that we've seen a million times. and being a character.
Right.
And somebody that we don't, you know, somebody we're struggling to cast because he's not a type that you necessarily see a lot of these kinds of stories.
No, and you know, my wife Becky Bartkowski is a writer and editor and a journalist, and also a huge fan of noir and a huge fan of these kinds of books. And we were talking about it, and she said, "I only see Jonathan Ames as Happy Doll." Like, you know, and it's clear. I mean, he's a self-referential writer. So maybe there's a world where he stars and directs in it. Who knows? You know, because like, I do see him. I often would be imagining Jonathan Ames in my head. I don't know about you.
It's funny. I did the same thing. And even like Bored to Death, I only ever saw Jason Schwartzman as Jason Schwartzman, even though he's called Jonathan Ames. And like, it's an insert character. And yet he didn't seem like the idea of Jonathan Ames I have in my head.
No, for sure.
Whereas
for
in
sure.
this, yeah, I did picture Jonathan Ames shooting, you know, criminals and like getting his face punched in. Like, I think that's a very probably narrow experience for the reader, because you have to have a sense of what, you know, writer Jonathan Ames looks like, who has never done any acting to my knowledge.
He's briefly in Bored to Death as a naked guy.
that tracks completely.
So there you go.
I do have to go back to Bored to Death. I think it was on at the time, at a time when like I was, I think when I dropped cable and it was only on HBO, and
before
Max or whatever it's called now came along.
It's fun. I'm sure they'll wipe it from the streaming service at any minute now as
Never underestimate David Zaslav or whatever his name is.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be their next tax write-off or whatever.
All right. Well, that's our movie. Thanks again, Jason Woodbury. Go out and read his work on Aquarium Drunkard. Listen to Transmissions wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any thoughts on Sunshine Noir or other ideas for movies that need to get made, hit me up on Blue Sky at Mike Vago, and you can read Student Journalism, hear College Radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. We'll be back next time on...
Why is this not a movie?